A German-based group called Pedia Press is trying to raise enough money to do the impossible. They want to print a copy of Wikipedia. Yep, a print version of the constantly evolving, endlessly edited, crowdsourced online encyclopedia. To say this would be a massive project is an understatement. To say it makes sense, well, that's a whole different issue, NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
1,000 volumes, 1,200 pages each, more than 1 million pages in all, about 80 meters of shelf space. That's what it would take to make a printed version of Wikipedia. The idea, says Christoph Kepper of Pedia Press, is to let people see just how much information is in the online encyclopedia.
Nowadays, you just use Wikipedia every day without even thinking how large that might be. I mean, the English Wikipedia has 4.5 million articles. Nobody can imagine this number. It's only when you see this in print or in a physical form that you realize how large it really is.
Kepper and his partners are trying to raise $50,000 through an Indiegogo campaign. Their plan is to exhibit the book at a Wikimania conference in London in August.
We basically thought, okay, let's put up a big bookshelf and put the books into it and let as many people as possible access this shelf and interact with that and just get the feeling of, about how large it is by, for themselves.
This is not an idea that I think is good.
Lee Matthew is a blogger for Geek.com. He thinks a printed Wikipedia is unnecessary, a waste of paper and other valuable resources.
I understand from an artistic standpoint what they're trying to show. I think, though, that the beauty of what Wikipedia is gets lost when you try to print it. It's a constantly evolving thing. Trying to put something like Wikipedia that is constantly evolving into a print form just doesn't work for me.
Pedia Press is sensitive to the criticism that a printed Wikipedia would use a lot of paper. In fact, they're going to plant trees to make up for the paper they use. That makes Jordan Taylor, who writes for BetaBeat, feel a lot better about the project.
I totally get it. I totally get where they're coming from. Because, you know, when we look back at media history, we can look at old books, we can look at old newspapers, old magazines, but there's no way to really go back and look at the history of the internet. And I'm imagining us teaching kids in the future about the history of the internet, and how are we really going to go back and show them what it looked like in the 1990s and the 2000s?
In fact, the partners at Pedia Press say they do think of this as a period piece. After it's shown at next summer's conference, they would love to find a more permanent home for it. Matthew Winner, a blogger and elementary school librarian, says he'd like to see that happen.
This is public knowledge, so putting it somewhere on display where the whole public can access it, you know, New York Public Library or something like that where everyone has access to it. The Library of Congress, I think that's a wonderful idea. You know, we have the user data of how many people are accessing and interacting with Wikipedia online now. It'd be fun to see how many people are coming to see that print resource. And that's something that we will only know after it's printed.
Winner says a lot of people, including many librarians, are skeptical of Wikipedia as a reliable research tool. But he thinks seeing the encyclopedia in print might change some of those attitudes. And Winner loves that at the exhibit next summer, they plan to have printers, kind of like old newswire machines, that will constantly create updates.
I think that might even be more interesting than the Wikipedia printout itself, just for us to watch how quickly people are interacting with the document.
But one thing they can't do, says blogger Jordan Taylor, is edit the printed version itself.
That's the inherent fun of Wikipedia. You know, sometimes you stumble across a paragraph that definitely shouldn't be there, and it's a little alarming, but I think that's sort of the, you know, you have to love Wikipedia warts and all.
Pedia Press still has a lot of money to raise with its campaign, which will come to an end on April 11th. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
If I said Christy Mathewson, Honus Wagner, Cy Young, would you know what I was talking about? That's right, they were all great old-time baseball players. Here is a slightly tougher one. Bobby Jones, Harry Vardon, Gene Sarazen. Bobby Jones should be the giveaway on that one. They were all great golfers in their day. And now that you are warmed up, here is the real challenge. Frank Hart, Dan O'Leary, Edward Payson Weston. Well, I'd never heard of those people until reading about them in Matthew Algio's book, Pedestrianism, when watching people walk was America's favorite spectator sport. Hart, O'Leary, and Weston were champion walkers, American sports heroes of the late 19th century. Matthew Algio, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
And when was the golden age of American, not just walking, but American pedestrianism?
The 1870s and 1880s. And what happened was, in the decades after the Civil War, there was mass urbanization in the United States. And there wasn't much for them to do in their free time. So competitive walking matches filled a void for people. It became quite popular quite quickly.
You're saying this is a measure of how boring life was at the time, that going to watch some guys walk was considered a huge entertainment.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who would say professional football is boring, but people still watch it. One thing to remember, these six-day walking matches, and the rules were pretty simple. They would just map out a dirt track on the floor of an arena. Many of the matches took place at the First Madison Square Garden in New York, and the lap was about 1/7 or 1/8 of a mile. You could only walk 6 days because public amusements were prohibited on Sundays. And so beginning right after midnight on Sunday night, Monday morning, the walkers would set off and they would just keep walking right up until midnight the following Saturday. But people didn't go just to watch the people walk. It was a real spectacle. There were brass bands playing songs. There were vendors selling pickled eggs and roasted chestnuts. There were a lot of celebrities who attended the matches. James Blaine, the senator from Maine, was a fan. So was future President Chester Arthur. Tom Thumb attended many matches. Mm-hmm. And so people went to see celebrities and see the spectacle, not just to watch the people walk.
And in a six-day race, the winner would be the person who had walked the farthest distance during that time. So that could be 500 miles.
Yeah, 500. By the end, these guys were walking 600 miles in 6 days. I mean, they were on the track almost continuously. They'd have little cots set up inside the track where they would nap. But generally for 21 hours a day, they were in motion walking around the track.
Matthew Algio, let's just stipulate here that the publication date of April 1st on your book is a sheer coincidence. This is not something you've made up. The men I mentioned earlier, Edward Payson Weston, for example, this is a real person. Who was he?
He was one of the most famous pedestrians of the 19th century. He was a bookseller, a door-to-door bookseller from Providence, Rhode Island. And what happened was, in 1860, he made a bet with a friend on the presidential election. And Weston bet that Lincoln would lose, and of course he lost the bet. And the terms of the bet were that the loser had to walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days to see the inauguration. And Weston did this, and it generated much publicity. People were fascinated by the idea that somebody would walk from Boston to Washington in 10 days in the dead of winter on these horrible roads. And all along the way, large crowds came out to see him. And after the war, Weston, still famous, decided to capitalize on his fame by taking the act indoors. He would go to a roller rink, say, and attempt to walk 100 miles in 24 hours. And people would pay 10 cents just to come and watch him walk in circles for a day.
Dan O'Leary.
He was the first great rival to Edward Payson Weston. I call them the Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier of their generation. Weston was a flashy guy. He wore ruffled shirts and sashes and capes and carried a cane. And Dan O'Leary
was sometimes played cornet as he was walking. Yeah.
He really understood that it was about entertainment as much as it was about an athletic event. Dan O'Leary, on the other hand, was kind of a taciturn guy. He was an Irish immigrant from Chicago, and he would walk ramrod straight upright with his arms moving like pistons.
And as an Irish immigrant, you assign him a role not that different from what Jackie Robinson did in baseball a century ago.
Yeah, he was really one of the first famous Irish-American athletes. And he was from Chicago, which, of course, had a large Irish population. There was almost kind of an internationalist rivalry between the two of them. Weston representing Old England and O'Leary representing New America, the kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps America, a guy that was self-made, came to the States with nothing and made the equivalent of $1 million today, engaging in these walking matches.
And Frank Hart, another pedestrian star, was African-American.
Yeah, he was actually an immigrant from Haiti who was a grocery store clerk in Boston and on a whim entered a six-day race in Boston and performed so well that he immediately moved up to the major leagues, so to speak, taking part in some of the biggest six-day races in New York. His picture was in the papers, on the front page of papers from coast to coast. The Negro Wonder is what many of the papers called him. It was always mentioned that he was black, but it was an opportunity for him and for other African Americans at the time to take part in what was largely a white sport.
Now, like any self-respecting professional sport in America, pedestrianism had a gambling scandal, a fixing scandal.
Yeah. Gambling was a big part of the allure, no doubt about it. You could bet on who was the first pedestrian to drop out of the race, who would be the first pedestrian to, say, achieve 100 miles in a race. There were so many different ways that you could gamble on the walking matches. And so the pedestrians themselves were often susceptible to attractive offers from gamblers to fix races.
Edward Payson Weston was actually dogged by, at one point, allegations of taking performance-enhancing drugs.
Yes, he was found to be chewing coca leaves while he walked in a race in 1876. This wasn't strictly illegal, but it was considered unsportsmanlike and outright cheating at the worst. He admitted that he used coca leaves in a race, but he said it was under the advice of his doctor.
Speaking of the advice of doctors, throughout your book, in many races, you describe the refreshment that the walkers, the pedestrians would take. The most popular one was champagne.
Yeah. Champagne was considered a stimulant, and a lot of trainers, these guys had trainers, advised their pedestrians to drink a lot of champagne during the race. They thought that this would give them some kind of advantage. The problem was that a lot of these guys would drink it by the bottle. That definitely was not a stimulant, to say the least.
What do you figure put an end to pedestrianism as a major spectator sport in America?
Well, a couple of things, really. In 1885, an Englishman named John Starley invented what is called the safety bicycle. Before the safety bicycle, bicycles were the penny farthings with the ginormous front wheel and the tiny little back wheel. And the penny farthings weren't very nimble or fast, but the safety bicycle, which is the bicycle we know today, these were much more nimble, much faster, and they were much more interesting to watch, especially at the end when the competitors were completely sleep deprived. There would be spectacular crashes, and of course the crowd enjoyed that a lot.
Yes, I'm sure that was a major attraction. Matthew Algio's book is called Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
There aren't many people who could get away with singing this on stage in Germany.
Hitler had only one big ball, Goering had two, but they were small.
Bette Midler did it. She sang this tune about a certain part of Hitler's anatomy during a world concert tour nearly 40 years ago. When Bette Midler sat down with us in our New York studios, I asked her to read a passage she wrote recently remembering that trip.
Long, long ago, around 1980, through a veil of hot, briny tears, I seem to recall that I toured the world with my show for the first time and lived to tell. I was 35 years old, cute as a button, and excited beyond belief. I was going to see the world, and the world was going to see me.
This is from the new introduction to Midler's book, A View from Abroad. It was originally published back in 1980, and there's a new edition out today. The book takes us to a time before Bette Midler was in movies like Beaches and Down and Out in Beverly Hills. The younger star would wear masks and costumes on stage, playing scantily clad and scandalous characters, like a wheelchair-riding mermaid and, of course, the divine Miss M.
I had just come off a picture. That was my first movie, The Rose, and we went right into rehearsals for the world tour, and I was completely discombobulated. Half the people that I usually worked with I didn't have, so I was like pulling people from, you know, hither, thither, and yon, and some of them were a little crazier than others, and so the adventures that we had on the road were really much more extreme than they usually are.
And they were some adventures. I mean,
there were some adventures. There's a lot of embroidery in this book, I have to say.
There is.
Oh, huge. It's all lies, okay. Except for like 10% of it, which is the truth.
You embellish a little.
You
bit.
Have to embellish a little. Come on, some sequins, some beads.
But the life on the road, I mean, that was accurate. I mean,
yes,
that was,
the truth of the life of the road is...
There was alcohol, there were late nights,
yes.
There were some of your dancers getting into trouble in different European cities.
Yes, not just them. I mean, everyone got into trouble. I mean, there was lots of bail bondsmen lurking around our venue. It was fun. It was youth, you know, youth.
Now, among all the outrageous costumes Bette Midler wore on that trip, one stands out. There's a photo of it in the book.
Tell me what we're looking at here.
Well, this is a picture of me in a hot dog suit.
Right.
And one of the tragedies of it was that they did not give me a way to get out of it. I could get in, and then they Velcroed me up, and then I couldn't get out.
Uh-huh.
So the first night that I wore this hot dog suit, they literally had to lay me down on the ground and rip open the Velcro. You know that horrible sound Velcro makes?
Sure.
And then I stepped out. I forget what I was wearing underneath. I must have been wearing something. But it was an idea whose time was not quite... It was half-baked, as they say.
A half-baked hot dog. Well, let me have you read, because there's one moment. I mean, your writing is hysterical. I was laughing reading this thing.
Okay. It's funny, you know, the things that go through your mind while you're waiting to suffocate inside a foam rubber wiener. Things like, what the hell am I doing here? What was I thinking of? And the inevitable, I deserve this.
You know, the hot dog suit reminds me. I mean, what were you doing by trying to become a different persona when you were performing?
I think I'm doing what all the girls do. Now that's what they do. They didn't used to, but I was trying to hide. I was hiding. I was entertaining, but I was also serving myself. I didn't have to give too much of myself because I was busy creating another character.
But what were you hiding from?
Well, I'm not the kind of person, at the time I wasn't the kind of person that really just wanted to stand there and sing with a band. I didn't really think it would put people in the seats. Why would they go to hear a singer who's a good singer, but not a, you know, I'm no Whitney Houston. I mean, I'm a good singer, and the thing that I have that a lot of people don't have is that I can communicate the essence of the song's lyric. You can go so far with who you are yourself, but then you think, oh, maybe I'll be too dull. Let's spice it up a little bit with her. You bring in another character.
Give me an example in your
career.
I'm shy.
I'm a shy person. I was born sort of shy. And I don't really like to be on all the time. One of the things that used to distress me about the situation that I found myself in once I became well known was that when I would go to a social gathering, people would expect me to be that person that I was on the stage. You know, that kind of loudmouthed, brassy, in your face, that girl who was, you know, would flash you. And I didn't want to be that in a social gathering. I wanted to be the lady that I am.
You do get into a bit of your childhood in this book. You grew up in Hawaii, and you described yourself as a worthless dandelion lost in a garden of orchids.
Yeah, well, that's how I felt.
Why?
Well, you know, we were a very quiet family. We were very isolated. In my school, my sisters and I were the only white kids. I kind of got by staying out of the way, keeping my head down, and just minding my own business, but it was very hard. You never felt like you had any value.
And what did performing give you? Did it give some sort of opportunity for this little girl who
absolutely. Absolutely. It was a moment to be in the limelight and a moment to say, you thought I had no value, but look what I can do.
And in this book she wrote over three decades ago, Bette Midler wrestles with how to define herself as a performer, often using humor. She jokes about what the headline of her obituary might read, perhaps Diva Dies in Hot Dog Mishap, or simply Bette Dead. But the second line is always the same. Began career at Continental Baths. She did find fame performing at a gay bathhouse in New York City, and she says for years, reporters would ask the same question.
What was it like to be in a bathhouse? And it's like, if you're so desperate to know what it's like to be in a bathhouse, go to a bathhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get them to stop asking that question. So I sort of sent it up in the book.
So in 2014, what's the headline you would sort of joke about would be how you're going to be defined?
I think it would be that I made a difference in Parks and Gardens.
And we should say you run an organization cleaning up Parks and Gardens in New York.
And I think I would say she planted a million trees in New York City. She helped plant a million trees in New York City. That's what I'd like it to say. She raised a good child. She had a good marriage. And she was liked.
This is a very different person compared to the Divine Miss M.
I know. It's so sad.
Were you tearing up jokingly, or was that...
No, I tear up. I'm like, I cry at traffic lights.
I apologize for thinking you were joking.
No.
What struck you there when I asked you about the Divine Miss M?
No, the idea of the obituary, you know, it's so... Let's move on from death, shall we? Let's talk about life. Miss M, God bless her, has been very, very good to me, and I'm grateful for her. I'm glad I thought her up. I'm glad my hairdresser gave me the name. I miss my hairdresser. He was great. There's a lot of people that I miss.
I just wonder, is there a song that you feel like connects us to the real Bette Midler, the real you?
So many wonderful songs, so little time. Well, there's Some People's Lives, which Janice Ian wrote, which I really, really love. There's Hello in There that John Prine wrote that I still sing. In fact, it's a song about old people, and when I started singing, and I was very young, and now I'm one of the old people. But it's mostly the ballads, I'd have to say. The ballads, I think, really represent who I am.
Bette Midler, thank you so much for coming in and visiting us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You know that old trees just grow stronger.
Bette Midler's book is called A View from Abroad. It's a remembrance of her 1978 world tour, and it's just been reissued. This is NPR News.
In her best-selling book, Room, the writer Emma Donoghue imagined what life would be like for a little boy, born into captivity to a mother who'd been kidnapped. Now she has imagined a possible solution to a very real crime. It was a true-life murder in California in the late 1800s. Here, Emma Donoghue describes the facts behind that new novel, Frog Music.
On the 14th of September in 1876, on the very outskirts of San Francisco in a grimy bar, a lot of bullets came through a window and they killed one woman in the room, Jenny Bonnet, who was a professional frog catcher, and they left the other woman, Blanche Benon, a burlesque dancer, they left her unharmed.
That crime was never solved, but Emma Donoghue has gone through historical records to write what might have happened. She shaped her novel's characters using court documents and newspaper accounts from the time, starting with the murder victim, Jenny Bonnet. The young woman was known around San Francisco for selling frog legs to restaurants and also for dressing like a man.
She shows up quite often in the records as getting arrested for cross-dressing, which was against San Francisco's city laws. And she manages to crack jokes. You know, even in a one-paragraph newspaper report, you'll have her joking with journalists or telling the judge, well, you know, I can't change out of my pants in the evening, Your Honor, because I don't have any other clothes. Do you want me to go naked? So that sense of ebullience and that maverick sensibility, it just leapt across the centuries at me. And I thought, I have to explore her story.
Well, let me just mention that there's another main character here. You mentioned Blanche and Jenny. Another character, perhaps, is the city of San Francisco itself, and it's 1876. What was the city like back then?
The city was wonderfully ramshackle. It had been thrown together really fast by the miners and the restaurateurs and the prostitutes. And a few decades on after the gold rush, it was trying to sort of clean itself up. So there were all these new laws against, for instance, the carrying of parcels on a long stick, just because that was how the Chinese tended to carry them.
Oh, let's remind people there was a substantial Chinese population there. Many of them had been brought to California at some point, or their family members had been to work on railroads and so forth.
Absolutely. So they were totally necessary to the building of America. And yet the white people in charge were trying to sort of tidy up the city by moving the Chinese out of sight. But really, it was a city of liberty. And it was known not just for its freedoms, but for its diversity and its very urban mindset. And also the city was in the middle of a very untypical heat wave. So it was burningly hot all that summer in San Francisco. And they had a smallpox epidemic. You couldn't make this stuff up.
So we have Jenny, this woman who flouts convention, who's a woman who wears pants, and we have Blanche, who's a prostitute. And I guess one of the driving forces in this novel, I don't want to give away too much, is that Blanche begins to be pried away from her life of dancing and prostitution.
I tried to be really subtle about prostitution in this book. It's not remotely pro-prostitution as a story, but I wanted to tell quite a subtle story of somebody for whom the sex trade seems to be working just fine. Blanche feels that she's got loads of power when she's dancing and these helpless men are throwing money at her heels. But I wanted to find moments in which she realizes that the trade is actually costing her too much. And in particular, she's had a baby and has farmed it out. And I wanted to look at the subject of mother love and see, could it possibly grow up on the stony soil.
You've just used a phrase that I think opens another door into history. You said that she had a baby and farmed it out. What do you mean by that?
In those days, they had a form of full-time childcare, informally known as baby farms. The dark name for them was that these people were angel makers, meaning your child was so likely to die that it was almost like a factory for turning children into angels. It might also have been known as a foundling home, but really these places were utterly grim, and you put your children in them if you had no other option.
This is a reminder also that life expectancy used to be a lot shorter, and a major reason for that was immense rates of infant mortality. Children died at unbelievable rates in the 19th century.
Right. It wasn't that 40-year-olds were keeling over in the street. It was that not many people made it to adult life at all.
Can I ask about one other thing, Emma Donoghue? From the very first paragraphs of this book. You have a character singing, and people continue to sing, and you print the lyrics again and again in the book. Why did you do that?
I got really interested in music partly because my main characters have performance backgrounds, but also because music was such a wonderful way to show cultures forming themselves, like all these different ethnic groups in San Francisco literally rubbing up against each other, borrowing each other's songs. So the musical traditions are so wonderfully mixed and impure.
Did you find yourself humming or singing a song as you were writing?
Oh, I did, and I listened to so many versions of them. A lot of them I found in the work of Pete Seeger. He was just such a treasure house of song. And some of the songs that I found it hardest to track down in terms of when they were first published were the rude songs, because songs with dirty lyrics, often it seems like they've been around for centuries, but nobody dared write them down. One particular one that Pete Seeger does called Darlin', it seems that it's been around at least since the end of the 19th century, but it was very difficult to find a published version of it.
Do you sing at all?
Oh, badly. For this book tour, you know, I'm making myself sing any bits of song as they come up in the course of the novel, but very much an amateur.
Can you sing something for us?
I'm blushing even as you ask.
So, no, come on. Anything here you want to sing?
Yeah, I'll do one I've done in readings. I'll give you a little verse from Darlin'. Darlin', better love just one. Darlin', better love just one. You can't love more than one and have all the fun. Darlin', better love just one.
What a lovely song. So that's a song that's been around for a long time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's certainly been around since the end of the 19th century. But changing all the time, that's the wonderful thing. They morph in every generation.
Emma Donoghue's latest novel is called Frog Music. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Oh, darlin', you can't love but one. Darlin', you can't love but one. Oh, you can't love but one.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Darling, you can't love two. Darling, you can't love two. You can't love two and still to me be true.
This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Maggie Shipstead's new novel, Astonish Me. Shipstead's debut novel, Seating Arrangements, published in 2012, was a national bestseller that won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for First Fiction and the Dylan Thomas Prize.
The title of Maggie Shipstead's second novel is Astonish Me. She did just that, astonish me, with her debut novel of 2012 called Seating Arrangements. After reading that novel, I likened the then 20-something-year-old Shipstead to Edith Wharton with a millennial generation edge. The comparison remains sound. Through her fiction, Shipstead gains entry into exclusive worlds and trains her opera glasses on private social rituals as well as behind-the-scenes hanky-panky. In Seating Arrangements, Shipstead infiltrated the compound of an old WASP family gathering for a wedding on an island like Nantucket. Witty asides and spicy insights were served up as freely in that novel as the Bloody Marys its characters kept tossing back. Compared to that crumbling old money stronghold by the sea, the closed world in Astonish Me is less jolly and even more self-regarding. That's because Shipstead here is scrutinizing the world of professional ballet. In fact, her title, Astonish Me, comes from the signature challenge that Sergei Diaghilev, founder of the Ballet Russe, issued to artists and dancers working with him. At the center of Shipstead's tightly choreographed story of frustrated passion and ambition stands Joan Joyce, a dancer whose gifts and discipline are good enough to earn her a place in the corps, but not to propel her into the spotlight as a prima ballerina. When the novel opens in 1977, Joan has discovered she's pregnant, and she's decided to keep the baby and leave the ballet. It's an unforgiving world. Here's Shipstead's narrator relaying Joan's thoughts about how little she'll be missed once the other dancers, who keep tight surveillance on one another's bodies, notice her pregnancy. When she stops dancing, class will continue on without her, every day except Sunday, part of the Earth's rotation. Her empty spot at the bar will heal over at once. Unlucky Joan had indulged in a quick fling with an old beau while on the rebound from a masochistic affair with Arslan Rusakov, the Soviet ballet star she helped to defect to the West. Think Baryshnikov. And in fact, while you're thinking Baryshnikov, you might also know that 1977 film he starred in called The Turning Point. There's a certain resemblance here to that tale of a former ballerina, played in the movie by Shirley MacLaine, who's drawn back into the dance world she left because of an unplanned pregnancy when her now teenage child shows promise of being a prodigy. The same thing happens to Joan. Her son Harry grows up in California, resolutely immune to soccer and baseball, and instead nuts about ballet. His passion and talent pull Joan back into Arslan's fiery orbit. Sure, it sounds hokey, but similar to classical ballet, the power of Astonish Me arises out of the pairing of a melodramatic storyline with scrupulously executed range of movement. Shipstead's narrator leaps around into different characters' heads, back and forth over time, and she's so precise in conveying fleeting thoughts and physical details that her flawless technique renders the contrivance of the plot inconsequential. Listen to the way mundane observations gracefully yield to transcendent yearning in this passage. The subject here is Joan's old friend Elaine, who's become a principal dancer with a ballet company in New York. She is 31 now, her body already less tolerant and cooperative than it was. She doesn't smoke, drinks less, eats well, has cut out drugs except for coke, just a tiny bit before performances and at intermission. She scrabbles against her inevitable decline, works to retain her strength, stave off injury. She has had stress fractures, torn ligaments, surgery on her left knee. Never in her life, not once, has she danced the way she wishes to, but futility has become an accepted companion. Literature is a kinder art than dance in one respect. A writer's achievement stays put on the page for us readers to appreciate whenever we feel like it. Pick up Astonish Me, and I think you'll appreciate the ease with which Shipstead sweeps you into this insider world of sweat, narcissism, and short-lived magic.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Astonish Me by Maggie Shipstead, which will be published next week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yue Shaw. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.